Hi, this is Phil Lernis, and I'm going to read this announcement precisely as it's written. As the co-host of Chilpack Hollywood Hour, it's always delightful to shoot the transatlantic breeze with the UK Midweek Drive team. Together, we aim to provide the best possible audio backdrop for political sand-nut tea, spelled with a U, in the 21st century. The Is Phil Lernis reporting from the middle ground between science and superstition, and you have entered the podcast zone. I did not correct some obvious typos and incorrect word choices, because honestly, I barely understand the UK version of English to begin with.
So what I'm saying is, if you've actually got a movie which has actually got defecation and urination in it, it shouldn't win an Oscar. That's my bottom line. How No Man Land did it, I just don't know. I mean, fundamentally, Mank was robbed. And I will say that, Sebastian Mann, and maintain that. Frances Dormand, fine actress, did lovely things in Billboard, Ebbing, Massachusetts, Three Billboards, a lot of time. But somehow I just feel that, for me, No Man Land, no, 6.5 to 7 out of 10. Oh, but I see we've been joined by indeed the people who's actually sort of anchoring this movie thing. We've got Richard Fitzwilliams, who might have one or two views on Nomadland himself. And of course, Robin Pierce back with us again from that point of view, who will probably be stowing away somewhere if he's not actually wanting to go for, well, this was Midnight Sky done by another name. However, Richard, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Indeed, it's been quite a week and the Oscars began it. I have to say that it's one thing, it's very interesting to discuss the winners, which most of which I have to say, because there was one notable exception, as well you know, had been predicted. And of course, also, what happens when Steven Soderbergh gets to produce? I know there were three producers, but he was the main one. A ceremony. I have to say, I really have to say, I enjoyed it because it was there was a touch of glamour, and at least we were edging towards some form of normality, and there was some fashion to admire. But there were lots of buts, and my goodness me, look at those ratings. I mean, we had this with the Globes. I mean, they were down 2/3.
And Richard, if you're going to go woke, you go broke. It's quite simple. The Oscar ceremony is not going to actually start attracting those sort of numbers. I'm pleased to see you did actually watch it. Probably one of the few folk who did.
Well, I had an early morning stint, I have to say, which I always do on Oscar night. I mean, there was less. I mean, there's no doubt there's less interest because, and this was the fundamental flaw, I think, at the heart of what Soderbergh was doing. I do think that it can be interesting. I've never liked the cutoff. I know the Oscar ceremony is too long for a lot of people. I know the arguments regarding cutting individual awards out and putting them in at the end and all the rest of it. Everyone wants their 90 seconds, shall we say, of fame. But the problem here, Soderbergh let some of the winners talk, and Daniel Kaluuya, who won as predicted, I would have gone for Keith Stanfield, but both for the same film, Judith and the Black Messiah. He had some fun. And certainly Thomas Vinterberg, a film I haven't seen, Another Round, very touching, talking about the tragedy of his daughter and so forth. You could get that. But the trouble, again, was that a lot of people, most people, have not seen most of the films, and where were the clips? I couldn't understand the lack of them because we had 3.25 hours. The other thing was, where were the songs? Again, another rather puzzling decision. You have to break up this business of self-congratulation, which you're obviously going to get in the Oscars. And the third thing that rather surprised me, In Memoriam passed so quickly that it, I mean, if you blinked, you'd miss. And usually they give some credit, say, to the greats, Dame Olivia de Havilland, for example, or, I mean, someone like Sean Connery, who everyone's heard about. I mean, again, it was a very, very curious, no harm in putting it in a railway station. I mean, why not? The Dolby Theatre wasn't used this year. But you had this feeling that Hollywood was not thinking of the masses of people out there, because it had under 10 million viewers, and we knew the numbers would go down. The Globes collapsed by 2/3 and the BAFTAs were down. We knew this would happen, but there was the attempt to get winners who didn't give speeches from the living room or the bedroom or wherever on Zoom. So, I mean, people have been so critical of the ceremony, and rightly. You needed those clips to establish the films. And so far as No Man's concerned, Land's concerned, I mean, people...
Richard,
of course,
Richard, never, never, and you know her well, never ever in her entire career would Olivia de Havilland have actually rated an actress who basically was defecating and indeed urinating on screen. Admittedly, she's acting and also playing an actress who's also kind of dealing with homeless people, who basically, they could have actually said to her, look, Frances, give us some of your money for this thing, as opposed to acting like a sort of wonderful sort of virtue signaling soul. I'm sorry, Nomadland is really getting it down for me on that.
I must take issue with you, because you missed one thing and I knew you'd miss it in Frances McDormand's acceptance speech, and that was that, of course, she was urging people to get back to the cinema. I hope you will be taking note of that. I thought she...
What I will say, Richard, is thank heavens for the Disney Corporation, who do the future of cinema, release it on a nice home service first, and then you can choose whether you want to go and watch it in the cinema. Sebastian, would you want to go and watch Nomadland on a big screen?
I have already seen it, and I'm not sure if it's the type of film I would rewatch, but I do lament having watched it on a TV as opposed to in the big screen. I might go back just for the novelty of going to the cinema.
Well, there we are. That's the lie, you see. Anyway, Richard, anything else you'd like to say? Let's just do a quick survey. Sebastian, did you watch the Oscars or the Academy Awards? So I've obviously got one in the background here, which clearly should be awarded for services to film criticism to Richard. But again, he missed out, just as he misses out each year on the BAFTAs. And it'll happen one day, Richard. Don't worry. I'm keeping it for you. Sebastian, did you see the ceremony?
No, I did kind of the classic thing I do every year, which is that I decide I'm not going to watch it, and then I end up just following it on Twitter, and I just end up staying awake because I see one of the awards come through and I'm like, well, I might as well just stay and watch.
Sorry, it. I actually can say Mank was robbed. I know. Kira Alsbrook, welcome along. Did you watch any of the Academy Awards? Is Nomadland something you're going to say, I'm going to check that out?
I did actually watch Nomadland and I was quite disturbed. So, but no, I didn't actually watch it this year. I did, however, keep up to date with all the fashion and what everybody wore. I mean, that was, I thought, more entertaining than everything that happened at BAFTA this year.
Yeah. I mean, just out of interest, Nomadland, how would you rate it?
Around a 7 out of 10.
Yeah. I'm a 6.5 to 7. I think there's some really, really good things about it, but there are also things where I thought, is this going to be the director who's going to be responsible for Marvel's The Eternals? What is Chloe Zhao going to do? I just don't know. Robin, Academy Awards?
No, I gave it a miss this year. I'm one of the people who keep saying, well, I'm not going to watch it this year, and then I'll tune in before I go to bed, and then I go to bed on a completely different day that I got up in. Sometimes I follow the whole thing, sometimes I don't. But the hook wasn't there this year. I just didn't feel kind of invested in it, so I gave it a miss. And in everything I've heard since, reviews of the show, I don't think I missed out. I don't feel like, gosh, I should have watched that. Because I believe Anthony
Bring back Hopkins, Ricky Gervais, that's what we say. Bring back Ricky Gervais.
Well, no. Firstly, Alex, that's outrageous, and you were deliberately saying that. Firstly, to provoke me, and secondly, you know perfectly well Ricky Gervais has never been used at the Oscars. It was the Globes, but you were having a little bit of fun. But yes, we're now coming to the centre point that Robin, in fact, has just mentioned. When you arrange a ceremony, never be absolutely sure of what is going or who is going to win, because you might change the order of the awards and you might be wrong. He might be in Wales and Anthony Hopkins was not there. Chadwick Boseman did not win. And frankly, the ceremony did look very, very foolish when you don't have Best Picture at the end, but you have Best Actor at the end in order to pay tribute, a posthumous tribute to a brilliant performance, albeit as Levy in as that 7-minute monologue, absolutely superb in Mulroney's Black Bottom. But Anthony Hopkins would have got my vote because I think it was a career best for a truly remarkable actor in a film so disturbing that, as I said some weeks ago, it made me feel older. I found my
Richard, I told you, you want to see Anthony Hopkins at his best, see Shadowlands, possibly actually go see Remains of the Day, yes. Certainly Pierre Bezukhov in War and Peace, the BBC television series, maybe even as Odin. But I don't know, I reserve judgment. I sometimes think, at least possibly he didn't go down the Francis McDormand route. Let's move on to this week's movies, though. Sebastian, one of these movies you saw 2 days ago and already you've forgotten it. Could it be Stowaway? I don't know. It could well be Robin's Choice. Where are you going to go with this heartfelt Anna Kendrick incarnation of how Anna Kendrick can actually, spoiler alert, basically deal with... Well, no, actually, before we go there, Robin, I'll share this with Rebecca. Rebecca, this is going back to the old Batman television series. Quick question for your good self. Three people in a boat. They all have... they have 4 cigarettes, but they have no matches or any ignitions. How can they actually have... How can they smoke those cigarettes?
Am I meant to know the answer for this one, or is this some sort of clever riddle?
it is actually a clever riddle, in fact, because they throw one of the cigarettes out of the boat and make the boat a cigarette lighter. That is the story behind Stowaway. Enough said. I'd still give it a 7. Let's go, Robin.
That's more of a joke.
Right. Let's do this as spoiler-free as possible. Stowaway. I was intrigued. The main plot twist is given away right there in the title. And the last time we saw a stowaway on board a spacecraft, it was Dr. Zachary Smith on Lost in Space. However, there is none of that campy fun humor with, you know, precocious child and a friendly robot in this film. It's set in the not too distant future. It's mankind's first manned trip to Mars. And I'll give you some background because it plays into the plot later on. It's a 3-person crew consisting of the commander, Maria Barnett, played by Toni Collette. We have Andra Kendrick as Dr. Zoe Levinson. And we have Daniel Day-Kim as David Kim. So a mixed race cast. The spaceship they have was designed for 2 people, and it's been stripped down of all the superfluous stuff. Some safety elements are gone, some shielding, to make it a 3-man probe. So they're just going with a stripped down bare essentials. Into the journey, some technical problems arise. And in investigating these, they find that a ground launch technician has somehow got himself stuck in a compartment. They've lost some oxygen. They've sustained some damage. This guy is badly wounded because of the violence of the launch itself, where everything gets shaken up. And they immediately have a problem. The spaceship is built for 2, adapted for 3. Now they have 4. Oxygen, they don't have enough of. They will never reach Mars with 4 people on board. So now we have the ethical and moral dilemma of what to do. Turning around, going back, not an option. They don't have the fuel because their fuel reserves to get back have been sent by an unmanned probe to Mars already. They are well and truly stuck. There's no get out of jail free card. So this is the dilemma that we have going forward. There is a plot hole, and it happens very early on. they seem very accepting of the character of Michael being a stowaway, with no real investigation that we are aware of how he got there. I mean, surely, you know, organizations like NASA are very particular about testing the payload up to the point of launch, and he would certainly have registered. We don't know why he's there.
Private sector, Robin. It's Hyperion, not NASA. That's the problem. That's what happens when you sell out to the private sector.
Yeah, but if I said Hyperion, I'd then have to go into the explanation about how it's not NASA and they didn't want to waste our airtime. So that's not addressed. But then again, that's not the real story. It's not his story of how he got stuck aboard the Mars probe. It's the story of how the crew are going to deal with this. And first of all, they try to train Michael, the stowaway, and integrate him into their mission, making him as useful as possible. But when the problem with the oxygen turns up, it becomes apparent that he has to go. And therein is the ethical dilemma of how do you tell him? Do you force him? Do you ask him? I mean, what do you do? Because every other member of the crew has a specific role. He doesn't. What happens? I think it's a beautifully made film. It was handled really, really well. I'm not going to give away any spoilers as to what happens.
On that point, Robin, let's see if that's prompted the memory routines of Sebastian. Sebastian, you've probably been prompted now. Can you remember seeing the wonders of Stowaway all of 48 hours or so ago?
Yeah, no, I do. I was maybe being a little harsh. I think I meant more. It just wasn't really a film that stuck with me, perhaps, after it finished. But yeah, I agree with Robin. It's a really well-made film, and I did enjoy it. It reminded me a lot of sort of like a bottle episode of old sci-fi shows, like takes place all in one location. They're trying to solve a ethical and scientific dilemma and stuff. Oh. Yeah, I did enjoy it. I think maybe I just maybe not so much my sort of film.
I'd give it an 8, but what the heck, you know, it nice in its own way, because Anna Kendrick's very good. Rebecca, did you manage to see Stowaway?
Unfortunately, I haven't, but it definitely sounds like one I want to watch. It sounds like it's very cleverly made, and although it's about something that's probably been done a few times before, it does sound very unique and done in its own way, so I think it's definitely worth the watch, so I'll be watching that one.
It's worth a watch for not only the amazing set design of the claustrophobic nature of the craft that they're in, but the special effects as well. I mean, it's a Netflix original, so we're not talking a huge, sprawling...
They reuse some of the sets from Midnight Sky, Robin. I'm sure they're all actually in there. It's all connected together.
But it looks great, and it's a good, solid story, really well told. The performances all round, I thought, were amazing. Even the part where Daniel Day-Kim, his character, comes up with a solution. You can see how he got there.
Of course Daniel Day-Kim's wonderful. He's Chin-Ho Kelly in the remake of Hawaii Five-O.
You can see how, even though what he does is morally wrong, you can understand how he got there.
Exactly. Anna Kendrick is a Yale phenomenon. She's still working through that. Kira, would you be tempted to go and see or check out Stowaway?
I might just watch it just for the pure fact it's about space. I haven't really ever watched a space film before, so and Robin's selling it quite well, so I might give it a go.
Well, certainly given Robin's
9 out of 10.
Oh, right. Well, given Robin's past track record with respect to Beneath and indeed Thunder Force, who knows where we'd go on that one. Richard, would you be tempted to see Stowaway?
Well, again, as Robin's choice of films and my own, it's fascinating. They diverge totally, which is most intriguing. I can only wish those who do see it. And I mean, if 9 out of 10 is his rating, it sounds very good for its particular type, and it's a very intriguing review. I can only wish them well, but again, I mean, it's just
Richard, if you liked Midnight Sky, which you did because you reviewed it over Christmas, you like Stowaway. That's all I would say.
Oh, well, that is interesting to know.
Onwards to something which confused me initially, which is why I don't think anybody's actually seen it as yet other than yourself, so it'd be an interesting tempter. It's not Quo Vadis, it's not Aida, it's Quo Vadis Aida, as in, what are these military guys doing behind me?
Quo Vadis Aida, yes, and it's the translation, it's a Bosnian film, is where are you, Aida, and it's a docudrama about the Srebrenica massacre, and this is a terrifying film. It was among the Oscar nominees, and director Jasmila Zbanek, who's also the screenwriter, has made a film. It's got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, and you can certainly see why by just simply by watching it. In 1999, the UN translator and former schoolteacher Aida tries to save her family after the Serbian army takes over Srebrenica, and this massacre has become notorious. I think everyone has heard of it, and this is prior to the massacre. She's a translator, and originally there's a meeting with the United Nations Colonel Tom Calamance, played by Jahan Heldenberg, and the mayor of Srebrenica. He reassures them that the United Nations and NATO will protect the town from with airstrikes if indeed the Serbs violate the safe zone. In fact, they walk in because there is absolutely no protection at all, and the thousands of inhabitants flee to the nearby United Nations camp. There's absolutely nothing that can be done about this. You've got thousands, you've got some inside the camp, you've got thousands outside the camp, you've got the Serbs occupying Srebrenica itself, and subsequently you've got a meeting with, well, the Serbs are perfectly well aware that the United Nations have absolutely no control and that there is no comeback. And so Aida has the desperate situation. She's hiding her husband Nihad and two sons, Hamidja and Sejo, in the camp. But what is to happen to them? Karamant tries to order an airstrike, but United Nations personnel who should be interested, vaguely interested, they're on vacation. So we have the awful situation when Mladic, who of course has become notorious, played by Boris Iskovic, walks into the city, negotiates with the United Nations just as a matter of course, because he knows that Calamans has absolutely no power at all. And then, of course, they move to the United Nations camp and they start transporting everyone back to Srebrenica. This is absolutely heartrending, by the way. It's a true story, as I understand it. And they start separating the boys and the men from the women and the children. And Aida tries to protect her family. What happens to them? What subsequently happens? Jasna Djuricic is superb as Aida. I won't reveal climactically what you actually see on film, but I can only say that this film will touch anyone who has a heart, and it's visceral, it's powerfully filmed, the photography is superb, the acting couldn't be better. Yes, I wish that the title had been a bit more accessible, because most audiences, as Alex has pointed out, you think of Aida, which has nothing to do with it.
And I think of Quo Vadis, the classic 1950s movie with Deborah Carr. Wonderful movie. I thought you were going all old school again.
If you go for Robert Taylor as a Roman, I suppose that fits. But I would also mention, of course, that what Alex was really doing was tempting me to mention Peter Ustinov's Nero.
Of course, as Nero, exactly.
Linked to the new British Museum exhibition, of course, which
there we are.
Nero was a victim of cancel culture. And if you believe that, you believe almost anything, I suspect. Though, of course, I haven't seen the show and I'm looking forward to it. But no, I mean, just to get back to this particular movie, it documents a real life horror story. It was truly remarkable. It's a horrifying experience to see it, and I just don't think that it could be better done. I just wish it was a more accessible film to audiences, because, of course, it, I suspect, hasn't been seen by many. But okay. I would urge anyone, I mean, it's awful what you're watching, and it happened.
Yes, awful as in difficult to actually sort of cope with on an emotional level, as opposed to a bad movie. Let's turn around and find Rebecca Bond. Will you be looking to seek out Quo Vadis Aida?
It sounds like it deals with some quite tough themes, but it's scored very highly with Richard. I think, you know, although it's going to be difficult to watch by the sounds of it, it's definitely worth it. So I think that's one that I might put myself through, definitely.
Okay. Kira, what about yourself?
Well, I think if it actually depicts real life, and even if it is quite traumatic, you know, I feel like it might be a good film to watch. But that's just me. I like watching true story films and things like that.
And believe me, Kira, the word quite, I mean, it is traumatic. I didn't dwell on the climactic scenes in this film, or indeed what happens specifically when they're separated, when men and boys and women and girls are separated. But I mean, it's reminiscent of the Holocaust. It really, really is horrifying.
Robin, from your own point of view, Quo Vadis Aida?
Well, first of all, I just want to point out that I spent the last couple of days trying to find my DVD of Quo Vadis, because I thought that's where you were going.
It is awesome, Robin. It is an awesome movie. And once you find Quo Vadis, you'll find it absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's the foundation of St.
I saw
Peter
it many years ago. I want to refresh myself so I could keep on a par with Richard on this one, but... You know, I thought, Aida, no, I'm not going to watch that. But it's something completely different. I don't know. Did you miss a comma somewhere in the title there when you told me, Alex?
No. Listen, I didn't. I simply forwarded Richard's line to everybody. So on that basis alone...
But I'm not going to correct Richard's grammar. I wouldn't be that bold. I don't know is the answer to this one. It sounds like it could be very heavy going, and personally, I use the cinema and films for entertainment to get away from the real world, rather than
Go and see Nomadland. That's all I have to say, Sebastian. Quo
Vadis. Well, if it's got people defecating, it's a no.
Let's move on to Sebastian. What about yourself and Quo Vadis Aida about the Srebrenica massacre?
It definitely does sound quite a harrowing and certainly traumatising film, but I did quite enjoy them. It doesn't sound great, but if a film deals with quite tough and difficult themes and does it well, that for me is a big sell. So, I think I will check it out. And it was up for the best foreign language feature. So, I think I will stick it on if I feel like. Really feeling miserable for an hour or so.
Maybe sort of it's not necessarily the feel-good moment. Maybe I say that is something that film does actually sort of share with us. And maybe we do need, as Richard says, to actually take more time to reflect on the tributes to Oscar people who have passed over the course of the year. But still, that's Steven Soderbergh for you. Let's not go there again. Let's actually go to the United States versus Billie Holiday, also in the Academy Awards. I don't think it did that well overall. I mean, it was touted as something which was going to sort of be an award-winning thing. Seb, did you see this to start off with?
I didn't know, unfortunately.
That's right. Kira, the United States versus Billie Holiday? Nope. Rebecca?
I've seen lots about it, but I haven't seen the actual film, so...
That can often be just as good. That can often be just the best thing to actually see. Lots about it, etc. Robin, I suspect it's a no.
Well, no, my last encounter with anything to do with Billie Holiday was, I think, Diana Ross of the 1970s.
Lady Sings the Blues. Let's go to Richard Fitzwilliams. None of us have seen it. Why should we go and see it if we should, Richard?
Well, it has a very, very fine central performance. I mean, I feel that I've been here before because I remember reviewing Judy with Renée Zellweger as Judy Garland, and she was the reason to see the film because she gave a superlative performance, but the film was mediocre. And you could more or less duplicate that review when you're looking at this. I mean,
Richard, you wouldn't cut and paste your reviews, surely. I mean, goodness me.
I have to say, Andra Day, as the singer with the orchid in her hair, who was considered one of the precursors, originally, of the civil rights movement, with her song Strange Fruit, which she recorded in the late 30s and which linked to the protest against the brutal lynchings that tended to occur quite often at the turn of the century and were usually African-Americans, of course, and therefore there's pressure on her to abandon the song. This is where the movie begins. And she is, as she uses drugs, so it is the Federal Bureau of Narcotics that go after her. And subsequently, after conviction, she spends a year in prison. But this is a film, it unfortunately is an inadequate film about a genius. The difficulty is, firstly, you've got when they're singing, as in the case of Judy, it's extremely good. You've got a superb, Andra Day is excellent. It's a wonderful performance. It won at the Globes. You can no doubt see why. Again, there were so many up for Best Actress this year. I know Alex would not choose Vanessa Kirby for Pieces of a Woman, but nonetheless, we had Frances McDormand for Nomadland. We had my choice, Carey Mulligan, for Promising Young Woman. We had Viola Davis for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Again, not one Alex would choose, but again, we have this. A remarkable star turn for someone whose life, she died tragically in the 40s, was terrifying, both, and you see this in the flashbacks where she's abused, and also a whole series of men, including, and this is where the film moves into controversial territory, but I wish it had moved into more involving territory, because Trevante Rhodes, who remember from Moonlight, plays Jimmy Fletcher. Now, he works for the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and he's responsible for having Billy sent to prison initially. Subsequently, and this wasn't, or certainly hasn't been proven, although there were rumours to this effect, they have a romance, and it's somehow you feel, I mean, there are so many abusive men, and there were in her life, her first husband, James Monroe, played by Eric Lorray Harvey, then her vicious second husband, Louis McNay, played by Rob Morgan, and also there's an abusive nightclub, and there's no doubt you've got a cast which, they're as performers, they act well enough. There are so many people involved in this film, somehow, although the period sense and the costumes and photography are perfectly adequate, you somehow aren't drawn into the story as you should be. And perhaps the fault lies with director Lee Daniels. I was pleased I saw it. I think Andra Day, as I say, is very, very good. It doesn't involve you as it might, just as Judy didn't, as it should have. And it's curious that you've had two such films. It's interesting also that this will perpetuate the legend of Billie Holiday, and there are scenes in it. You know, as I say, I'm very glad I saw it. Also, quite a good performance by Gadot Headland as Harry Enslinger, who's the narcotics chief who's after her. And it gives you, of course, an insight again into America's truly dark past. It's a film about deep prejudice and about an individual fighting, quite literally, to keep her head above water. And also, of course, all the tragic flaws in her character that led to her sad early death.
Richard, I mean, I do feel, as you know, I've spent the time.
I've suddenly been looking from my notes to what's behind you.
Yes. Well, it is actually the original Quo Vadis poster there that we actually have with Deborah Carr and indeed Robert Taylor, which I think is a wonderful little line. Again, vastly underrated and well worth looking at as an underrated classic.
Well, firstly, let me just say I did see it again quite recently. It wasn't vastly underrated, and it will be so static for people now, for viewers now. I mean,
if you can cope with Nomadland, you can cope with Pro Vadis.
If any of the team think that by seeing a 50s movie and you choose that one, you'll really be absolutely shocked by how puerile it was. Secondly, I must protest, Alex, formally, because you've introduced Quo Vadis during a review of the United States versus Billie Holiday, and it's got nothing to do with it.
Whither are you going? I just want to know, whither are we going? That's the key thing. It has been, another fascinating route through the whole thing. Let's just quickly find out, on the basis of Richard's lines there, will we be looking to see the United States versus Billie Holiday? Sebastian?
Potentially, but I may give this one a miss, I think.
Uh-huh. Kira?
I might give it a go. Might.
Rebecca?
I'm quite interested in her life, so I think the fact there's a film about it now, I just have to watch it, and Richard spoke quite highly of it, and it deals with some quite difficult themes again, but very well. So yeah, I'm going to give it a go.
And Robin?
Conversely, I'd be far more tempted to watch this than Quo Vadis Aida. I think I probably will watch this, actually.
There you have it. Upcoming, we'll be listening to some gardening experts about how we're becoming a nation of green fingers. All this and more on Madrid Drive Morning Edition. But for the moment, Sebastian Mann, Richard Fitzwilliams, Rebecca Bond, Kira Alsbrook, and Robin Pierce, huge thanks. Keep watching the movies.
Time for another Zoomer on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbeam.com. Keeping the COVID-19 bugs at bay.
Well, one of the COVID bonuses, you might well say, about the pandemic has been, of course, people have had the opportunity, if they've been fortunate enough to have gardens, to obviously engage more with the whole sort of gardening aspect. And indeed, 26.7 million people in the United Kingdom grew their own fruit, vegetable and herbs in the last year, including 7.4 million who actually were growing food for the first time. Well, to talk us through this wonderful feature and indeed a whole range of other things, we're delighted to welcome two awesome individuals. First of all, from BBC Gardeners World and indeed ITV's Love Your Garden, presenter extraordinaire Frances Tophill. How are you, Frances?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. And of course, head gardener at the Wellator Garden, of course, that's Claire Hattersley. How are you, Claire?
I'm good, thank you.
Excellent. Frances, let's turn to you first in terms of that whole sequence. I mean, you know, we hear tales from grandparents, et cetera, about how in the war, allotments, et cetera, we grow our own, et cetera. And of course, allotments have had a bit of a wonderful history in terms of people growing their own fruit and veg, et cetera. This is really a good news story in terms of obviously sustainability, I would have thought as well, really.
Absolutely. I mean, the more we grow our own food, the less pressure we put on farming and especially importing from all over the world. So yeah, if we can grow things, we can make a positive difference. And that's the whole point of this Get Green Fingers campaign that Wellator are running, is to encourage people not to just grow for ourselves to eat, but actually to think about the wildlife too, to think about the wider impact of our gardening and how they can be so positive if we just make some small changes.
Herbs, of course, are very much a feature here. Mint, rosemary and parsley are all actually being used from that point of view. Claire, is that something which in terms of growing herbs, is it because it's relatively easy to grow herbs? I mean, I'm thinking possibly a bit like my watercress attempts basically back in the day. But what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I think all of those herbs lend themselves to being grown in pots. So I think they're a great option for people who don't necessarily have a full garden, maybe just yards. But yeah, I mean, the company I work for, we actually, growing herbs is our business. So herbs are very dear to my heart. But yeah, I think what's interesting as well with the survey results is that it's a lot of younger growers are moving towards gardening, and it's actually the herbs that the younger growers were kind of veering towards. So I think the real popularization of cooking programs has made a difference there, because people see fresh herbs being scattered on dishes, and it's a very easy way in to bringing something you've grown onto your plate. And the next step, I think, is vegetable growing.
And Frances, clearly, in terms of the whole process of growing our own food, growing our own herbs, fruit, vegetables, etc., it's also very therapeutic, I would have thought, actually going through that process.
It definitely is. And I was one of those people last year who unexpectedly had more time to spend in my garden. And it was only a rented garden and it was a tiny little concrete patch, but I completely filled it as full as can be with edibles and herbs. And just following on from what Claire said, I have to say that herbs give them, that they're so beautiful. I think that's the thing. There's been a tradition and a lot of people think that when you grow vegetables, they're unattractive and they usually get put at the far end historically away from the house, far away from your, where you have to look at. But actually veg growing and herb growing can be so stunningly beautiful and it should be just incorporated into every part of the garden, I think. So yeah, the more people get growing, the better.
Certainly back in 1921, when Wellida was actually established in the first place, who would have thought 100 years later, Get Green Fingers would be actually functioning on this basis? And Frances, just share with us why you partnered up with Wellida for this particular campaign and why we're talking about it today.
Well, I'm willing to share a lot of my own feelings about sustainability. You know, I think as gardeners and as human beings, we're all aware of the impacts that we can have on the planet. And finding a company that make lovely products, but also are growing things themselves. It's something I'm hugely interested in, is growing productively, not just for food, but also for skincare, for dye making, for medicinal herbs. There's so much that we can get from plants. And Wellida are growing biodynamically and with sustainability and a kind of circular wildlife benefiting element incorporated into all of their gardening. And over the years, I have slowly been shedding my training and moving away from using chemicals, which I haven't used for years, actually, but also moving away from digging and from weeding and just embracing nature a lot more in my gardening. So it's really exciting to team up with Wellida on this.
And then obviously biodiversity, something which is very much in the news and continues to be this notion of ensuring that we provide the opportunity for wildlife, be it mice, be it field voles, be it rats, any of the sort of aspects of that, probably actually giving them a place to actually stay. And of course, the wonderful bumblebee.
Absolutely. I mean, these are things that not many years ago people would have called pests, you know, foxes. So unfairly maligned, but actually they are a really valuable part of our ecosystem. All of these so-called pests are actually wildlife, insects, fungus, bacteria, microbes, you know, all the soil, all the plants, they all are a part of an intrinsically connected system, which we're also part of. And we have historically just tried to eradicate everything from that. And people are waking up to the fact that that is not only terrible, but actually as gardeners we have the opportunity to turn the tide on insect decline and really make a positive difference, and I think people are really into that. I know I am.
Claire, turning to your good self, I mean, Frances has, I think, done a fantastic job for actually making us think again about the humble carrot, the beetroot, the other vegetables that might be out there sort of lost and put to the far end of the whole thing. What are your own favorite vegetables to actually grow and to develop?
Oh wow, well, in my garden, my favourite veg, I think I'm proudest of my asparagus bed, but I just love it all. And I love growing flowers and herbs and veg all together. Like Frances says, we don't have to grow veg in straight rows. That's a kind of agricultural thinking. That's for efficiency. But vegetables are beautiful and they can be part of a beautiful tapestry in your garden. So I think growing wildflowers in amongst your floral borders and beds is wonderful. And a lot of our native species of insects have actually a very close relationship with our wildflowers and our, what most people class as weeds. And I think it's, if we can make space in our gardens to welcome everything in, all of life, and support all of life, then our gardens are a fabulous resource for wildlife and for biodiversity in general.
It's particularly fascinating to find that potatoes are most popular in Edinburgh. I would have thought it would have been Lincolnshire, actually, but still, obviously, that's the line from that side of things. Carrots for Northern Ireland. Nottingham, of course, it's the sprout, or indeed, as I often refer to them, the flatulence bomb. But maybe I need to rethink about that from all sorts of reasons there. I mean, finally, Frances, any other sort of surprises from that point of view? In Birmingham, obviously, the hub for homegrown asparagus that we were just talking about there.
I just think it's really interesting how regionally it's different. And I suppose it's part of the climate of those areas and what grows best, because I think people tend to do what they're successful at the most. But I just think it's genuinely heartwarming to hear that people are growing food and enjoying it. And I hope that the Get Green Fingers campaign encourages people to stick at it, even when life gets busier and we get back to work and we don't have quite as much time to dedicate to it, but that we can do it in a way that maybe we step back, we put a little bit less effort in, we still get produce and we still get beauty, but we also, by doing a little bit less, can benefit the wildlife a little bit more.
The classic Francis Top Hill approach to maximum gain for minimum effort, which is surely the way to go.
Yeah. I think so, definitely.
Classic line. Claire, finally, where can people get involved, or how can people get involved with Wellida's Get Green Fingers campaign?
Well, if people go on our website, so it's wellida.co.uk, they can access our open garden, which is a virtual garden tour, and they'll find out lots of information there and also more information about the Get Green Fingers campaign as well.
Claire Hastley, head gardener at the Wellida Garden, and of course Francis Tophill, presenter extraordinaire and gardener extraordinaire, huge thanks, many thanks indeed, and hopefully we'll speak again in the not too distant future.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
May the 16th, very significant day. Why, you might well ask? Well, because it's going to be officially a family recipe day from the point of view of life and the universe, and indeed passing recipes down families. 47% apparently of British folk have a family recipe passed down over generations, and 40% of us actually fear that it could be lost in the mists of time. Well, hopefully to actually address this challenge and actually give us some thoughts about the upcoming Family Recipe Day and so on, we're delighted to welcome home economist extraordinaire, that's the wonderful Pippa Leon. How are you, Pippa?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for that lovely introduction, Alex.
Oh, good, Pippa. Now, let's talk about this research, which of course was conducted by Onken National Set Yogurt. And were you surprised by some of the findings, or did you sort of think, yeah, well, that's what happens. It's evanescence, the sort of gradual fading from memory of things that once were a crucial part of our existence.
I think the thing that perhaps didn't surprise me, but I think is maybe one of the easiest things we can address, is how many people are worried that these recipes are going to be lost to time. I think you said it was 40%, and I think that's so easily fixable. It just requires a little bit of forethought, I suppose, and thinking, okay, right, let's get the kids, let's get the nieces, nephews, whoever, the family together, let's make a recipe, and let's talk about why we love it and why we don't love it, and we can change those bits we don't like and really make it your own. And I think there's a lot of people who consider handing down a family recipe almost like handing down a family heirloom, and I love that image. I think there's something really beautiful about passing a recipe down that's brought your family so much joy, and families in your extended family before you so much joy. And I think there's just something really lovely about being able to connect with different people, different places even, through the food you eat.
There is, of course, the classic line of the secret ingredient, which various multinational food companies will say, you can't reveal that secret ingredient. And maybe that also goes down to family recipes as well. That presumably can be a bit of a challenge as well if you want to actually get great-grandmama's final jam recipe before she actually sort of shuffles off the mortal coil.
Yes, well, this is a great point. I think there's a lot of people who would never be able to replicate, say, I don't know, their grandma's rice pudding. And they're not quite sure what it is. They've got close, but they're not quite there yet. And I think it's the perfect opportunity to ring her up and say, hey, granny, I really need your recipe. I can't quite get it right. And I think, you know, as someone who cooks and writes recipes, I love it when people ask me about how I made something. It's a huge compliment. So I would definitely encourage you to find out what these little secret ingredients are and write them down. And it could be the start of a family cookbook, or even those bits of paper with recipes scribbled on that gets shoved in the back of another cookbook. But they're all so important, and they're all such lovely things to hold on to.
Although these days, presumably, you could all end up on electronic media, and we don't know what could happen in the event of an electromagnetic pulse. But let's hope it's all good. You know, let's keep a balance between our media forms. Pippa, have you actually been the beneficiary of any family heirloom recipes that have been passed through the generations?
We have a few recipes. They're not so much family heirlooms, but we have a cottage pie that gets pulled out on lots of big family gatherings, sort of the kind of thing you can plonk in the middle of the table, throw some sides around it, and everyone just gets tucked in and talking over each other, and a really big family sort of gathering. I've also got, and this is actually a good point about family recipes, it doesn't actually necessarily have to be from your family. We have, there was a lady who used to live next to my grandma many years ago, and she made what I still believe to be the world's best carrot cake. So that's almost been absorbed into our family as a family recipe for us. And that wasn't even from someone in our family, but it means something to us. And so we've taken that, and it's now part of our food heritage, if you like. It's something that means a lot to me and my sister in particular, but certainly my parents, we all have a nice reminisce over a carrot cake every so often.
Perhaps we can refer to it as the human family, the kind of extended family from that point of view, as opposed to the blood relative family. Just a thought, yeah. Really.
Yeah, absolutely.
And from the cultural aspect, are there any sort of cases of as we look around the globe, et cetera, because clearly we have a multicultural, diverse society, which does exist, et cetera, that, you know, you've got native Australians coming up with initial recipes. We've got, obviously, sort of folk from South America with their own recipes. How wide-ranging do you think this could actually be in terms of, obviously, those recipes coming into play for Family Recipe Day?
Oh, so what? As wide as you like. It's we want to hear about all your recipes. We want you to get in touch and cook them and take a picture or take a video. And we just want to see whatever it is that brings your family joy. And if you can use Onca Natural Set in the process, even better. And the thing about it, it's so delicious and so smooth and mild that it works in so many things, be it savory or sweet, baking or curries or anything. So it's a really good time to have a look at your recipes and tweak them so that they work perfectly for you and your family.
Of course, it's a very interesting point you made about the curry there, because curry has been with us since the sort of 17th, 18th century, the first spices coming through on that system. And yet, of course, the mild curry, which is there, does make use of yogurt, and presumably Onca Natural Set yogurt would actually fit well in terms of the korma variation of curry.
Yeah, absolutely. It's traditionally made Onca Natural Set, and it's made in its own tub, and you can find out about this on onkan.co.uk, but it makes it perfect for so many different kinds of cooking, and actually curry is a really good example where yogurt is a really useful ingredient. If you've got kids or adults who don't like things quite so spicy, yogurt's a really good way to just bring the spice down in something a little bit. So it means, you know, you can make a big batch of curry, and if mum likes spicy food and your little brother doesn't, that's fine, doesn't matter, chuck a thing of yogurt on the table and everyone's happy. And that's what's so great about eating with family, is you can find a way to make something work for everybody.
Presumably the yogurt would also work with carrot cake as well, which would be an interesting sort of combination of all sorts of things.
Absolutely, it would. Yogurt works very well in cake, actually, so that's a great idea.
Marvellous. Okay, so you've plugged, obviously, Onca Natural Set yogurt, which is fine. That's one web address. What about folk who are actually keen on getting involved with Family Recipe Day? I mean, they've got a couple of weeks to obviously get sorted through, etc. It is Sunday the 16th of May, of course. How can people actually keep up to date with respect to that and find out what they need to do?
So everything you need is online at onkan.co.uk, but the most important thing is to get in the kitchen and get creating your family recipes. And we need you to take a picture or maybe a little video of it. And then we need you to share it with the hashtag OnkanLegendary so that we can see your recipes and we can have a look through them. And whoever comes up with some brilliant recipe will be invited to join a cook-along with Marvin Humes, and we'll be cooking one of his family's favourite recipes, which are chicken skewers, and they're marinated in yogurt. So there really is so many ways you can use yogurt in your cooking. But everything you need to know is online, but mostly get in the kitchen, create something that you think is delicious, and get a picture of it.
See, I always used to say it was the height of hubris, or indeed crass 21st century culture, to actually take a photograph of the food that you're about to eat. I just thought, no, never, ever do that with respect to, you know, tweeting ahead. But clearly, Pippa, you've actually just addressed a way in which, in this particular routine, you can justify the taking a picture of the actual food and posting it online from that point of view. There is a rationale behind it.
Absolutely. And some of us make a living off it, so it's not all bad.
There you go. So two final questions, Pippa. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
It has, absolutely.
The next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again? Will you come back probably post Family Recipe Day and actually share with us more delights on the wonderful world of food and more?
That would be my pleasure.